Hello and welcome to Conversations on Karate. I'm Sue.
I'm Greg. And we have a special guest today. Mr. Jamie Club is with us. And we've looked at Jamie's biography. And if we decided to run through it, it'd probably take us a whole podcast worth of time. So, Jamie, I'm going to ask you to briefly summarize your martial arts journey. And then we can jump into the reason we're here today.
Okay, yeah, I think, I mean, my martial arts journey began in earnest, not with a week's judo training, which I did when I was 9 years old, and I didn't really have much interest in it back then. But really, I was part of a traveling circus family. We settled down to do film work in the middle of the Cotswolds. Obviously kept the connection with the circus culture, and that still remained a big part of my life. Still did a lot of travelling, but our base now was in the middle of the Cotswolds, where we're cut off from everything. We got involved in just about every area of show business you can imagine. I mean, I'm talking about everything from sort of pantomime to feature films to documentaries to video games and everything else in between. And there was that was a very sort of surreal world for me. And martial arts became almost like my escape hatch, if you like. It was my portal into something else, into something that wasn't a part of our regular life. You know, so we might be doing a feature film one day, next day we might be doing some still photography job or something along those lines. And I was growing up like Mowgli with a wide variety of different cubs in our wagon, and then eventually our little cottage. So that was, you know, that was very much, you know, the normality of my life. And but also cut off from everywhere, because we were in the middle of, you know, we're in the middle of nowhere as well. So you know, being well traveled, but at the same time cut off from everything. Anyway, long story short, I got into comic books first, and then martial arts magazines, and martial artists became like my celebrities, if you know the untouchables in my life, you know. And and I was determined to get into martial arts. First tried to pursue ninjutsu, didn't go very far. But at that point I'd accumulated lots of different books on martial arts, so therefore I was finding out about lots of different martial arts systems. Settled down in a local system of Cicado, which I did for couple of, I've got a black belt in that. All the schools closed down in the area, not because of me, I hasten to add. jumped into Taekwondo, which was the natural connection, because Cicado is, well, the style of Cicado I did anyway was is now pretty much extinct as far as I know, even though I know a lot of the boys who were still part of that, they went off to do other things, and girls as well. But then went to Taekwondo. That seemed like that was the place it came from, so I trained in that. Then I cross-trained in kickboxing after a few years, began teaching kickboxing, got involved in professional wrestling, extreme professional wrestling, wushu. I studied on and off, along with some traditional Chinese martial arts, because I wanted to get back into performance. I wanted to do my family, I was an eighth generation performer. My family has a lineage of performing in front of audiences. And the idea was that it was almost, it was one of my things that I needed to do. I wanted to be able to professionally perform in front of an audience. And then I was legitimately an eighth generation performer of my family. It was just something I wanted to do. And I ended up doing it through professional wrestling, not as a professional wrestler, I seem to add. Now that'd be too easy. Not that professional wrestling's easy, and certainly one that the type that we didn't, but that would be, it'd be too comfortable fit, shall we say. Now I decided to do a gothic martial arts performance act that involved dancing as part of a pro wrestling promotion. It was a really, really long way for me to be able to get my cabaret act out. I don't do things the short and easy way. You know, it's so anyway, did that for a few years. I got actively involved in it was extreme professional wrestling, of course. It was the punk element. It still exists to this day, the promotion. Mm-hmm. The business partner, he's got his autobiography out and mentions all our crimes in that. Got out of kickboxing teaching. Didn't like the direction that was going. Even though it got me all around the country, I just had a complete exposure to the dark side of martial arts, all the bad sides that you could possibly imagine in the martial arts world. Obviously, I'll still do the wushu. But then I stopped doing that as I stopped performing, because I wanted to get back into being more reality based. I wanted to get back my feet back on the ground, so to speak. I wasn't much into performance. I wanted to get back to the essence of martial arts, and I gravitated towards first the traditional jiu-jitsu style, then to Muay Thai. And about 11 years previous to that, I'd written a letter to Jeff Thompson, I connected with him. He got my writing into Martial Arts Illustrated. And then from there, I got involved into a lot of intensive self-protection training, got instructorships in different systems there, got connected with Mo Teague as well as Jeff's instructors. And the writing for Martial Arts Magazine has enabled me to be able to meet some of the best teachers in the country and at the same time train with them. So I was able to meet them, train with them, and then write an article on them. It was a really, you know, useful thing. I became like the Where's Wally of the seminar circuit. I was all over. So again, traveling again, going all over the country, going to different seminars and training and doing private lessons with these different instructors. Did a documentary on it, cross-training in the martial arts, because obviously that clearly was my base. I was a martial arts nomad, or a combatives tramp, if you like. Just traveling everywhere, training in different systems. I started I don't know how to call it a system or even a method, but my approach to martial arts was called Club Chimera Martial Arts in 2004. I ran a club for 10 years, started doing seminars and workshops and things like that. Cross-trained a lot in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, mixed martial arts, did some in ACOTS Green, did that for several years. And just kept up with my CPD on that front of it. 2014, I started teaching full-time private lessons. So I started teaching private lessons and seminars and courses. And that's pretty much everything I do now is just an extension of what I started then. My latest book, When Parents Aren't Around, is I suppose the latest incarnation of that.
Awesome.
I think that's the most impressive history I've ever heard, ever.
I'm also a compulsive liar. No, when I'm joking.
Some or all of that may be true. We'll leave it up to you to decide.
I'm sat in a basement somewhere in that, and I'm just really, really good at social media. I wish that part is a lie. That definitely is a lie.
You led into it perfectly. When Parents Aren't Around.
Yes.
The new book. It's a second edition, am I right?
Technically it's the third, but I say it's the second edition because it's really the only. It's only a third edition in the respect that it was published by a traditional publishing company first. Then I took the rights and published it myself, and then this is a complete rewritten, re-edited version with photographs. So it's both a second and a third edition. You know, technically you could say it's the third edition, but I consider it to be a second edition because this is the only one where all the changes have been made.
So let's talk about what the book is, and then, because what I'd really love to know is you know, why the changes and what's kind of informed you to, you know, update and what have you. I know you said you've put photos into it, but it'd be great to know what kind of new learning you've had that's made you update. We've been looking at it. It looks just like, oh my God, they're so good. Right there in the intro, it's like so much good information. Seriously, it's amazing. It is. Tell us about the book.
Okay, so the actual genesis of the book, or the update.
Let's talk about the genesis of the book.
Okay, so it all started in 2007. I was in Disneyland Paris as part of a team that was supposed to be setting up the Martial Arts Festival, the European Martial Arts Festival. So Disneyland Paris were going to run this. It was a wonderful trip. Honestly, it was just expenses paid, got to stay at, you know, Disneyland hotel in Paris. It was a group of us and we just had a great time. Sadly, the festival was a disaster. But one of the things that I pulled from it, apart from the fact that I got loads of free rides and got a chance to teach at Disneyland, which in itself was really good fun, was at this meeting, at the preliminary meeting we went over in this December 2007, Summersdale who had produced my two documentaries in 2005 and 2006, Cross Training the Martial Arts. The head of their production wing was a guy called Nick Atkinson. He was talking to me over drinks about, ideas. And obviously at the time I'd been writing a lot about children's self-protection. I'd written a four-part piece on children's self-protection for Martial Arts Illustrated, which is in my book Mordred's Victory now. It's republished in that. And he said, why don't you do a book? Why don't you do a children's self-protection book? Go on, we can publish it. Summersdale will publish it. And he gave me a word count, what it needed to be. And I said, yeah, okay, I'll go away and do that. I mean, I hadn't thought about doing a children's self-protection book. That really, I don't think I'd even entered my mind. That wasn't what was on my agenda. But I got working away. And then Nick left Summersdale and I was kind of stuck. There was no contract or anything. I'd sort of like gone on this idea, this agreement. And I thought, right, OK, I'll see if I can hawk this book around other places. And I had support from Robert Higgs. He wrote the Boy in the Photograph, Anti-Bullying Expert, whatever Have I Done to You? And I believe actually he's relaunched a lot of his seminars and courses now, actually, Robert. But he was really supportive of me. And he tried to get the book into print as well. I got support from people like Francis Gilbert, who wrote Yob Nation. Dr. Stephen Bryars, a TV child psychiatrist, he liked the book and kindly put his support behind it as well. There was Claude Knight from Kidscape. So a lot of people, actively involved and published work and really enjoying the book and writing. Jeff Thompson, of course, gave his honest feedback on me, and he was really supportive of the work because a lot of it was, the kernel of it, the original ideas, were coming from the stuff I'd learned from him anyway. And I was just transporting it to a child audience, which is where it all started with my child self-protection teaching in the first place. Anyway, I had a really, had quite a struggle trying to getting it around publishers. But then it went on the back burner and other things developed and things went on. And then I got in connection with Excellence Publishing, Robert Agar Hutton's company. He principally published ebooks, and that became one of the books that he agreed to publish for me. Obviously, that was a traditional publishing outlet because he just he agreed to take it on and published it. Obviously, I didn't have to pay a penny or anything, and it came out in that form. And that's how it's existed as an ebook. And of course, I got a lot of responses from martial arts teachers in this country and outside, and said, well, we'd like a printed version. And like them all, they enjoy the printed format. And they said, we'd like, when people come into our classes, parents are sitting in the waiting room, why not have that book available? And also we'd like to better offer this to our students. And it's all right having an ebook, but people do like, to have a tangible book. I'm the same. To be honest, I only have a few Kindles, even though I've written several ebooks. I'm a traditional reader. I enjoy having the, that form. So I thought, well, I've got to get round to doing that. So I got in order. I got my Wrong Fu into print, and I got my Mordred's Victory into print, and I eventually got round to doing the When Parents Aren't Around. And of course, when I came round to doing it, I thought, well, this needs a big update.
So this all came out of your 2004, did you say, children's?
Yes, yeah, that's right.
So you were teaching that then. So how did you come from being in martial arts and training martial arts to focusing on children's self-protection, which then led into this, I've lost my words. Go from teaching self-protection into writing the book.
Okay, well, the first thing was I wanted to start my own class, and it's as simple as that. And I wanted to teach things my way. I taught kickboxing someone else's way for 4.5 years, and I didn't like it. And then I gone back to training, back to roots. No interest in teaching, but then I've always loved teaching. So as the years went by, and I got heavily invested in the self-protection side of things, and more into the full contact cross training in the combat sports as well, I thought, well, I want to run my own class, and I'd like to teach things the way that I want to teach things. So I wrote a syllabus up, and then as I was looking at it, I was going, well, I need to have children's classes. And I was being told, and I knew as well in the industry, that children's classes make up the the largest, you know, number of students. So there was, you know, there was a business decision in there. But obviously, I was passionate about teaching things my way. And I remember when I very first started teaching children, I was advised by an industry martial arts firm, you know, teaching children was a great idea, really, really good idea. Yeah, absolutely, teach children. This is going to help build the foundation of your income. You can teach martial arts full time, get children's classes out there. So I thought, yeah, great, okay. And I went, yeah, and what are you going to teach? So what are you going to teach them? I went, I'm going to teach them self-protection. And the first instinct for that is, well, of course you teach self-protection. Of course you teach self-defense, because this is one of the things that a lot of martial arts clubs offer, don't they? You have this big yes. list. Mm-hmm. Learn confidence, learn self-defense, learn this, learn the other, you know, whatever, you know, achieve enlightenment, whatever, this entire amazing list of things. And I always wondered, whenever I look at this list, when a martial arts club is offering all these amazing things, I thought, imagine if you attributed that to virtually any other service or any other option. Imagine getting a car where it said, you know, amazing economy, environmentally safe car that's faster than a Ferrari, and it's also safe for your whole family to get into, and you can pack everything into, because you should be going, well, this is impossible. Well, cool. You know, you can't pack all that into one thing. So my view was like, well, okay, look, no, I don't mean self-defense is one of the things I'm offering here. Not, I don't mean self-protection just going to be one of the things I'm going to, my focus is going to be on teaching realistic self-protection. That's why I've got no budget. And I've got a passion. I've got something I really want to do. And I think, it, you know, I know it's important. I've always valued child self-protection. I've always wanted to teach in some shape or form. And it came to me that, you know, if we're going to start with children, then if this stuff is going to be realistic, then surely it should be accessible to the more vulnerable members of our society. If you're going to teach something as a self-protection system, then surely that's, you know, it's not going to be, because it struck me that a large proportion of people who were involved in the self-protection world and the big proponents of it were, you know, they were physically tough, physically intimidating individuals. You know, this is what you're seeing, this whole image. I was going, but this is supposed to be self-protection. This is something that we're supposed to be offering to your average civilian. And actually, let's deconstruct this a little bit and say, well, if it's a really good system that you're offering there, then surely it should be accessible to people who are physically disadvantaged. After all, isn't that what the original cell of martial arts was in the first place? And if we go all the way back to when martial arts was first taught to civilians, when you go over to China and at the turn of the 20th century, and you know, you have soldiers coming back from these battles and from or couldn't get jobs as bodyguards or whatever, and then said, well, okay, we're going to open up a martial arts school, that's what we're going to do as a living, we're going to teach a family style of Chinese martial arts. And they were teaching civilians, and the big sell of it was, let's get the middle classes in. Okay, so how do we get the middle class in? This was happening, of course, in Britain as well. And we see this with Bartitsu. All of the Bartitsu stuff in the late 19th century was sold directly towards the British middle classes. The idea was that, you know, if you're accosted by a couple of roughs, you know, this is how we, you know, this is how we dispatch them with our bicycle. You know, or penny farthing, you know, this is what you get. So we get with all the Bartitsu stuff. And funnily enough, you know, there's a similar story being told over in Japan, you know, when Okinawan karate is coming over. If you look at the language of Funakoshi, if you look at the language of Mabuni, you know, these guys weren't working class people. You know, these guys were, you know, middle, you know, lower upper class people in some respects teaching karate. And you've got this whole idea that, you know, martial arts are all these peasant styles and all this sort of things. And a lot of it, no, it's not. A lot of it's coming from military backgrounds, whatever. And they're targeted at people who feel vulnerable, you know, people who haven't got experience with violence. Boxing was the same, wasn't it? You know, we go back another 100 years. You go back to the 1700s, and you've got, you know, the likes of Jim Figg in the 1720s, who's his best patrons are the gentlemen. You know, they're the people who are going to give him the money to be able to open up his school and the amphitheatres and to run the gyms and that, so they can learn a system of self-defence. You know, just where you've got, you know, in the early part of the 19th century, you've got Lord Byron getting his boxing lessons. And, you know, and so, you know, these are the people who are, you know, again, people who would be consider themselves to be vulnerable to muggers and attackers of all different descriptions. So it always was targeted at the vulnerable person. And if you get, as you go into the 20th century, you kind of got all this you know, Charles Atlas targeted weight training courses. You know, skinny men. Do you not like getting sand kicked in your face? Kind of adverts. You know, well, come and bulk up with all this. Which, you know, martial arts is all synergistically as a sort of evolved with this. You know, as it's been marketed to people. So it's long been the idea that, you know, a martial art or a self protection system is for people who need it. You know, it's not targeted at the soldier. It's not targeted even at anybody involved in professional violence, you know, with security or police force or things like that, even though these guys learn it, of course. But for the actual commercial marketing, it's to people who are going to be vulnerable. So my view on that when it came to children was, you know, these are the members of our society that a lot of the time we're targeting. This is where all the media is. This is where the karate kid, you know, all this kind of thing that's out there. So why not give those children access to something that's actually going to work for them, you know, rather than to say, because, you know, little Johnny and little Jenny turn up to their average martial arts class and they'll be going, oh, you know, well, why have you brought your children along? Well, they're getting bullied at school. They're getting targeted, you know. Okay, yeah, great. Well, come learn our system of martial arts and everything like that. Well, we're training to win the local competition. Well, I know. I've just brought here because little Johnny, you know, sick of getting wedgies in the locker room, and little Jenny's having a cash taken off her every day. You know, this kind of thing. It's going, yeah. You'll learn that part of it. But we're going to get training for this points tournament. You know, this is what's really to do that. You know, or we're going to, or worse still, I mean, whenever you turn up in a martial arts class and any discussion of violence is considered to be completely off the table. You know, you'll be go to, I mean, I remember I used to meet up with martial artists at a certain club and we'd all meet up for a drink afterwards. And, you know, anyone start talking about, you know, dealing with a violent situation, you'd be looked down upon. You know, you know, we're above all that. And this sort of thing. And you're going, yeah, but we've got to address this first, at least. You know, we've got to get this done first. So my point was, let's teach it accessible. So, of course, when I told this company who was going to, you know, help me on the business side of things, and they were lovely people, and they were really, you know, they weren't, you know, they were legitimate, and they were, their interest was streamed, you know, getting people working, doing what they love for a living. Well, teaching the sort of martial arts or self-protection that a lot of people were teaching for a living wasn't the way I wanted to go. I wanted to teach my way. Okay, which turned out to be a really bad business move, but that's a different story in terms of, running a club. So they were absolutely right on that front, but they looked at me like, you know, like, oh, you can't teach them this. You can't, you know, you know, you'll disempower the parents. You'll upset the parents, or you know. And I was going, but you know, hold on. And people would say, oh, you know, and there's always this thing about what, you know, what techniques, you know, are responsible. You know, can you not teach children? Well, any martial art technique, virtually any martial arts technique, is lethal. You know, mm-hmm. If we look at a punch, my great grandfather was killed by a punch. So, and that's like one of the most basic things. You know, he was killed on the cobbles. You know, he came from a gypsy family, not the circus side, completely separate. And he was, you know, he was killed on the cobbles. And it was a punch. It was a punch. His head hit the ground, you know, and that's what probably caused the death. But that's that background. And there's been plenty of other cases where things like that happen. So anything you're teaching, and you only have to look at katas, you know, the stuff in katas that is grisly. You know, there's face ripping. Breaking kneecaps, there's strangleholds, there's throws designed not to put somebody into a pinning position, but to physically hurt them as much as possible. Mm-hmm. All this kind of stuff is all contained within the martial arts. So, and if you're not teaching that as an application, then what the hell are you teaching them? You know, this is often the thing, but that's a discussion for another day. My point was, like, let's have accessible self-protection for children. And of course, when you look at that, people say, well, realistically, how's a child going to be able to defend themselves? You know, so the first thing people think is adult on child self-protection. And a lot of people go, what's the point of teaching that? The average child is not going to, no matter what you teach them, you know, an adult is far bigger, far stronger, far heavier, you know, mentally more mature, so they can read situations better. And whereas a child, you know, hasn't got experience, hasn't got the physicality to handle it. And you go, well, okay, well, that's another deconstruction exercise. The average citizen. Do you think the average citizen with two lessons a week can seriously overcome somebody who's lived a whole life of violence and knows how to target the actual person? So to me, it was like an exercise in, well, let's test these systems, because they should be, because the truth of the matter is normal civilians have escaped and have dealt with really violent people. OK, children have escaped adults, violent attackers. These are case studies. These aren't things. These are anomalies. They do happen. Yeah. So children do this. So the fact is that these things do happen. And how do we address this? So what your system should be doing is should be teaching that in the same way. And I look at self-protection in the same way as I look at first aid. Now, my view is like a first aid course, you know, is a self-contained course. It's taught in a very short length of time, but they're life-saving skills. Self-protection should be taught the same way. It's not a lifelong endeavor. It's, you know, lifelong endeavor is martial arts, which is really, really important. And a lot of martial arts systems started off as self-protection systems, but they became more than that, which is wonderful and it's brilliant. And I, you know, a good part of my personal, most of my clients at the moment aren't self-protection students. They're mainly people learning boxing, kickboxing, MMA, things like that off me. I mean, that's the bulk of what a lot of my teaching is. But my courses and seminars, a lot of the time, are self-protection, because my view is like it's a short, self-contained course that should be updated over a period of time in line with different things that have changed. So that's how I really start out my children's self-protection. And the children taught me a lot, I have to say. When I came to teaching children self-protection, they taught me loads. They taught me all the things that I was teaching wrong, because they're honest with their feedback. Mm. And one of the base. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say that sounds so interesting. I was going to ask for an example.
All right. So, so a general example that I would give is when you look at games, right? So, when a lot of martial arts classes begin their sessions with games with kids to keep the child, and the purpose, the objective of that is to keep the children interested. Okay, that's the idea. The objective is like, make it fun, keep it interested. And my view is like, well, if they've come here to learn a certain skill, then that's really what our duty is, to teach them that skill. And our duty is not to reward them with a volleyball game, not to reward them, not to keep them, you know, if they're going to be warmed up, then why don't they be warmed up in ways that are going to absolutely directly contribute towards the skills that we're supposed to be teaching them? And shouldn't that be the be end all of the entire lesson? And that became it. So what children taught me was things like, there is one very specific example that actually helped alter a lot of the way I teach adults as well. But one of the things, but I think the games is an important point to make, because the games are fun, but the games can immediately help you teach a teacher how to teach children to be better at self-protection. And escape is so important. So again, we learn about how soft skills are so important for self-protection. They make up the vast majority of self-protection teaching. And of course, this is a really important thing when it comes to teaching adults. I mean, I know that when Jeff Thompson said why he rewrote his book Real Self-Defense and turned it into Dead or Alive, was because he said the majority of people who are coming to me weren't people who are actively involved in handling violence, and they're the sort of people who I'd really, really wanted to avoid violence as best possible, that they'd be best served to do that, and that the best parts of self-protection are the skills you use to avoid violence, the skills you use to reduce a violent situation and limit the chances of a violent situation from happening. Well, those skills need to be transferred to children who, like it or not, face violence on a more regular basis than the average adult. Okay, when we drop a child off at school, a child has a 50% chance, and I'm just pulling that number arbitrary out of the sky, I've been, there's actually no, there's zero research or background on that one. But I'd say that if I'm saying 50%, I'm being generous on the side of those with optimism. But a 50% chance of being involved in a violent incident. You think about it. Children communicate with each other tactfully. They have very tactile behaviors. That's how children communicate. They're very, very physical, and this goes all the way up to sixth form. You know, from my experience of being at school and what you'll see. You know, the stuff that there's behaviors that children display to each other that would never ever be accepted in an adult workplace. You know, you'd have committed a dozen crimes by the end of the day if you did all the things that children did with each other in an average school day. Okay, so when I say violence, yeah, but different levels of violence. And it's all right, people saying, yeah, but okay, but that's children just roughhousing and all the rest of it. Yeah, it's true. Yeah, it is. And it's going to happen. And it's an acceptable, and to a degree, acceptable thing. But of course, children don't get bullied within that. You know, children get put down. Children get demeaned. And they get physically bullied in that kind of scenario. So they are facing those situations. They're facing, and this is what happens. And I would say it's, generally speaking, it's low risk and medium risk. Threats that they face, and the medium risk shouldn't be pushed aside. You know, medium risk is still a risk. It's higher than a low risk. And when I say medium risk, this is where all the bullying tends to happen. You know, it tends to be the part where the intimidation happens and what children have to face in that respect. So we knowingly do this. We drop our children off and we just hope that they don't get involved in a physical incident. But I can bet your bottom dollar that the majority of people listening into this who have got children will have had some report back from their child that they've been involved in some form of physical altercation during the day. And this is what happens from day to day. And all these things turn into bullying. Bullying is increasing at the moment. We know, statistically, we know that. We know that violent crime is increasing full stop at the moment. I mean, overall, we're in a safer time if we look at things historically. But within the microcosm of the moment, of this this particular decade, we've seen an increase in violent crime statistically and an increase in bullying. So physically, children are facing that thing. So when parents aren't around, that's part of the title for that. That's part of the empowerment issue, the fact that you're leaving children to deal with that situation. Now, if children can learn skills of how to avoid those violent situations, how to understand when a violent situation is going to happen and how to read the behaviours in another person, this is going to give them a good foundation. You know, this is going to give them, a better chance, not to be traumatized by bullying at school, which children are, of course, through the. I mean, I knew a child that had to go to speech therapy and even had plastic surgery due to extensive bullying at his school. I knew of another kid who went to a school, and I went to a very, my senior school, my secondary school that I went to was actually, inverted commas, respectable school. You know, it was very much, wasn't a rough school in any shape or form. But, rather tragically, a year 11, back then a fifth former, committed suicide due to bullying at that school. So, and I used to see a lot of it. It was a very, bullying happens a lot. And children face it. And we're often in a situation where the teachers can only do so much, as we know, within that thing, and we're entrusting a child to be sort of independent, and that can be all the way right back down to primary school, can't it? So, in those situations, so these are important skills to equip them and to better deal with that. So yes, so it's very important to teach these for skills for children on child violence, adult on child violence. Again, we need to pressure test that, and this is what we used to do. I used to get an assistant instructor, and we would pressure test escape drills for children. What things are working for them? And the honesty that the children used to bring back to us was how they dealt with those games, how they dealt, what they learned from those games. They would tell us things like, just running in one direction without looking over their shoulder wasn't effective. You know, they'd end up running into, dead ends and things like that. They're not looking around. That they tell us things like, guess what? If you're smaller, you're more likely to be picked on. You know, when we did some of these, we did different types of games. If you're slower, you're more likely to be caught. You know, obvious things. I know these are obvious things, but there's sometimes we try to make an even playing field for stuff like that. But these highlight the issues that children are facing. They taught us things like strikes to the groin when you're trying to escape from an adult. Aren't necessarily the best course of action. You know, they're actually the best areas for a child to attack on an adult who's trying to attack them will be like their hands, because they're the things that come straight to them. And that aligned with my knowledge of animals, wild animals. You know, when you see a lot of attack, when chimpanzees, for example, or primates have defended themselves or attacked people, the injuries that they've inflicted on a human have been to the hands, because they're the first things that come into view. I mean, Filipino martial arts, of course, have a whole, they attack the hands a lot of the time. that this becomes a big part of defanging the snake. So I was able to, you know, take some of the inspiration there to help develop some of the defensive stuff I would do on child on adult self-protection. So that was that honesty. So there were things that we would do. And one of the things that they really taught me, of course, was things like pad holding. It's as simple as that, as, making a connection, making training on the whole being more directly relevant. I mean, I know in the karate world, you've got this 3K issue, you know, that people talk about, you know, where you've got the kata kumite. Kata kumite kion, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know,
this
thing where people say, and none should meet.
Yeah.
You know, so you've got these things. It was something I encountered when I did taekwondo. It's the same thing. When I was doing taekwondo, my view was like, and now we're going to do self-defense. And I'm going, and I remember that one. I'm going, I thought, weren't we doing self-defense? Well, what the hell are we doing the rest of this stuff for? You know, that used to be like, I remember at the time when, you know, back when I was naive about such things. The same thing was there were so many other things like with our training that I wanted everything to be relative. So if I'm going to make kids warm up and move around, I'm going to make them walk with awareness and make them walk purposefully. I'm going to look for exit points. Where are the exit points in this room? Where do these exits lead to? And making them understand, taking these early situational awareness cues. So that was, you know, was part of it. But when it came to hitting pads, that was a classic example. So, you know, obviously we're so reliant on focus mitts. I mean, supposedly the history of focus mitts goes all the way back to Muay Thai and the holding of flip-flops. And Muay Thai was used as targets and boxers took that on. I mean, again, you don't see any footage before the 1950s of anyone holding focus mitts in boxing. And yet we've assumed they've always been here. And martial arts world has taken them on, haven't they? You know,
yeah.
There's so many things that we assume have always been there in our training or on our traditional. And it's mad, isn't it? It's like kick shields, isn't it? What were they? They're tackle pads.
Yeah.
They originated as tackle pads. And, you know, and you think that, oh, you know, the kick shields have always been around. No, they haven't. They probably haven't been around since the 60s. I think it's, you know, Bruce Lee was using them for, you know, using it. He actually uses a tackle pad.
Yeah.
He,
I was going to say, he might be one of the first, to be fair.
Yeah. I think he was probably a pioneer in that respect. Mm. I really did. I remember because Dan and Santo going, it was a tackle pad that we were using. And I found out from Ramsey Dewey, watching one of his videos, he was talking about the flip-flops with the for the Muay Thai and how they were just picking flip-flops and as targets and thinking. And I looked and went, oh my God, yeah, this. You look at video footage, you look of any boxers before the 50s, you know, there's no focus.
No.
And yet you've got all these movies often when they do like period movies of boxers and they're all holding these old focus mitts and they're back in the 1920s or even in the bare knuckle days and you go, they didn't do that. They didn't exist. It wasn't part of the training. But anyway, so we have focus, but focus mitts are a really valuable part of our training. But the trouble with focus mitts is they can get like any piece of equipment. They can become, we can become obsessed with it. You know, we can become, it becomes abstract, doesn't it? You know, it's like, you know, it's like you find this with a lot of martial arts. You know, people say the same thing with Wing Chun, with Chi Sao, you know, where you get people just obsessed with doing lots of Chi Sao and not doing the actual sparring or not doing the actual applications, but they're just playing Chi Sao for ages. BJJ, you know, you find people who, you know, even get away from competition where they start all the sparring from their knees when you don't even begin your competitions from kneeling down.
Yeah.
And then people, you know, really having problems when they go into a competition to deal with that. So focus mitts became, you know, my first sort of light bulb moment. When the kids came to their grading and it came to sparring, they started punching each other's hands. Now, I know I've just said the hands are an important target for focus mitts, but when you're looking at people the same height and roughly the same height and then when they're even just sparring, when they weren't even doing the self-protection part, but then they were doing this sort of attribute-based training, what I call, you know, boxing and kickboxing, and they started punching each other's hands. And I was going, where's this come from? And, of course, it was the focus mitt training. And we'd just done takedowns. They'd done a demonstration of takedowns, and then I did some adult on child self-protection as part of a grading, and suddenly all the kids were trying to take down these adults. And I was going, where's this come from? And I was going, it's because you've just trained takedowns. So I went, right, and I took this all back to my class, and I was going, there's a serious issue here that I need to completely deal with. You know, this, you know, we need to be honest about the stuff here. So target familiarization, children taught me about target familiarization. They taught me about when you teach actual strikes, you've got to have to teach that application directly to where they're supposed to be. And then you've got to drill those, and then you've got to have all your training has got to overlap what Ian Abernethy calls the training matrix. You know, you've really got to have this really overlapping and understand that, that, you know, that overlapping, so everybody gets that, okay, this is, we can do full power to a focus mitt. We can, when we're targeting somebody, we have to do touch contact. When we're doing pressure testing, we're somewhere in between, you know, something like that, you know, and then you kind of get, then develop this overall picture. So, yeah, kids taught me that type of honesty. So they taught me things like certain tactics that aren't going to work on a child and adult situation. And they taught me certain training methods that weren't effective, that, that weren't very, you know, that I'd assumed too much. Later, I got feedback from other teachers, students about, and you know, anti-grappling tactics for kids. I appreciate I'm talking a lot about the physical side of things, which only makes up a very small amount in my book. But at the same time, I think the relevance is that it's the principles I'm talking about here.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that the kids, you know, are actually bringing in the healthy amount of skepticism. They're the ones who are telling me things like, also when you're putting up fences, when you're using your fence, how natural it needs to be, you know, and how and, you know, and if you don't teach people. So that made me think about teaching more about boundaries, which is covered in the book. So boundary setting is really important. So before we even talk about the fence now, we talk about setting boundaries, which, of course, is a really important soft skill.
Yeah,
and then you build a fence on your boundary. Well, makes sense, doesn't it? If we're going to use the metaphor, let's take it all the way. So you teach children things like boundaries with what's appropriate for someone to behave. Well, you know, what are your boundaries? What are your social boundaries? You know, is, you know, what's appropriate discussion topics? What are appropriate with different people? You know, it might be okay to talk to parents about certain intimate details, but then that's not cool with somebody who isn't your parent. You know, there might be you know, again, on the physical side of it, you know, you might hug your friend, you might hug your close family, but you might suddenly not want to hug somebody who you're not very sure of, you know, this kind of thing. You've got your, so all these become like your, and also your boundary. And again, a child taught me this. I brought Ian to assess one of my gradings. My gradings were, didn't have any techniques listed back when I ran my class. We didn't list any techniques. We just listed principles and strategies. That was the whole point of it. I wanted it so that I could bring in a teacher with a good background in teaching realistic self-protection methods, had a proper understanding of realistic self-protection methods, but came from any style or system or association. And they could sit on my grading panel and they could say, that kid gets it. Do you know what I mean? So therefore, they know that kid, you know, that kid can physically do this. I don't care about the technical aspects of that takedown, but I know that that kid can take someone down under pressure. I don't care about the, you know, the technical aspects of that particular strike, but I know that that strike matters, that strike's going to work. I understand that person understands preemption, when preemption is acceptable, et cetera, et cetera. So one of the, when it came to the Q&A, he asked about fences to this girl, and this girl came back to him and said and started talking about boundaries, and then out of nowhere she started talking about emotional boundaries as well, and that was something I hadn't discussed in the class at all. And she'd taken that information and, you know, and expanded it into her life, and he was really impressed with it. I think she got a grading award or something like that after that one. But I remember him talking about this later on, and he was really like, you know, I think you've done a really good job, Jamie. I was going, yeah, a really good job. I think of it, she'd actually brought this straight into the lesson, and from then onwards went, yeah, but I'm going to do this. I'm going to really now, let's look into this. Let's understand more about emotional boundaries. Let's talk about social boundaries. Let's talk about, these are all the things that you're going to lay your foundation. And we start talking about things like something I never thought I'd cover, because I'm, you know, I really respect the scientific method. I try to have a very clinical approach as far as you know, the stuff we're teaching, because I want stuff to be robust. I don't want anything to be, you know, subjective. But I realized how important a moral compass was, you know, that actually a moral compass, if someone doesn't have their own moral compass, and it's an individualistic thing, you don't have a value system. If you don't have a value system, then number one, how do you value yourself? How do you have respect for yourself? And how then do you have to turn that into an effective attitude? And I'm sure you'll agree, attitude is without, no matter what you've got, no matter how many skills you've got or how good you are or even how physically good you are, without the right attitude, you're either going to get in lots of trouble or you're going to, or it's not going to be effective. You know, it's I mean, we used to hear on Crime Watch people talk about attitude. Remember the show Crime? I don't know if it exists, but you know, so you'd watch a TV show and there'd be a recreation of a crime situation, and you know, and I used to love the eyewitnesses sometimes because they'd come on and go, yeah, come to think of it, when I was on the way to Tesco's, I did think it was rather peculiar that that bloke was walking with a sawn-off shotgun and a balaclava over his face. and you'd often hear these kind of like things come back, but you'd hear situations where people would, you know, be a victim of violence of some description. And you know, I'm sure, you know, being involved in martial arts, both you guys have been involved in martial arts for so long and very aware of the self-protection stuff, and that you're probably screaming at the screen when somebody's there talking about, and then he followed me, and then I kept walking.
Yeah.
And then I walked further away, then I walked down an alleyway, and you're going, oh my God. And it's like, you know, you're getting worse and worse, this whole situation where someone's being followed. And you're going, you're making this situation so easy for this attacker. And you hear all this story, and you're going, when someone's in denial, and of course, all these awarenesses about, and you're going, and if you read Gavin De Becker's Gift of Fear, where, again, survivors of assaults, and they, you know, they'll tell you some intricate details about what happened. And you realize that how aware they were, actually. Mm. The awareness part wasn't the issue.
Yeah.
You know, it's important to understand awareness. It's acting upon that awareness that's the problem. And that's where the attitude comes into. A lot of us are very, you know, are surprisingly aware, but it's acting upon that actual awareness. Mm. So, you know, so attitude becomes important. So that then comes back to the boundary setting and understanding that. Then you become aware and you go, okay, well, I'm going to have my moral compass. I'm going to decide what is worth fighting for. You know, because again, a lot of this is really important when you talk about people's value systems. That's when you start getting out of this the best you can to diffuse the whole what Rory Miller calls the monkey dance situation, where you start saying, well, you know, fighting's for mugs. You know, it's quite simply, you know, if you want to fight, get in the ring, get in the cage, get on the mats. You know, don't step outside with somebody. Why would you do that? Why would you trust that person? You've already lost because you're doing what they want you to do. They ask you for a fight after school. Your response to that should be, hopefully, you know, no, I don't need to. And say, well, what are you, a wimp? So you can think whatever you like about me. I just don't want to fight you. I just don't. It's my choice. That's very hard for a kid to do. But again, if they've got a moral compass, if they decide, well, this is what is important to me, and you say to them, well, you know, so, well, if you're so tough, you know, why aren't you down your local boxing gym? Why don't you fight one of those guys? Why don't you fight a trained fighter? Why don't you get in the ring? Why don't you get in the mats? Why do you need to be outside with all your mates cheering you on? Why do you have to go into a place where you know you're comfortable with? And it's you know, all this, you know, because it's to often see when, you know, when people were coerced into fights at school. Yeah. This is the classic one where a kid feels like, well, if I don't fight, I'm going to lose face. Mm. And nowadays, especially with cyberbullying, you know, these things are going to be recorded, and now they're going to become, you know, so now it gets worse. And so it's not only the fight's not even done and dusted then. Not like it ever used to be. I mean, there was this myth that, you stand up to a bully. Sorry, no, standing up to a bully, there's a difference between standing up to a bully and doing what the bully tells you to do in terms of having a fight. You know, if you go to the fight, you've already agreed. They've chosen the place, the time, and in some cases, even the rules, you know, if there are any. And they've got all their support. And of course, they've also got, this is what they're comfortable doing.
Yeah.
You know, this is how they've done it. So you've lost all of that. And, you know, rather than changing the situation, rather than doing a Musashi, if you like, and saying, well, okay, now I'm going to choose the place, I'm going to decide what to do, and I'm going to level it all in my advantage, if you don't mind. You know, so I say, you know, let's go to the gym, because I know a good boxing coach, and I'm sure he can do, you know, he can deal with that. That's, you know, whatever. Or if that's actually going to, but in most cases, you know, you're saying, well, no, why would I want to fight you? Well, you're witnessing, well, no, you're bigger than me, you're stronger than me, you like to fight, I don't want to get beaten up. You know, is that okay? You know, a lot of kids don't want to say that. And you go, well, look at you. And you say, well, how brave are you? How brave? You're fighting me because why? Because you think you beat, you know, quick question. You think you can beat me up? Yes, you do. So, well, so you're going to have, let me get straight. You're going to have a fight with somebody you think you can beat up. Okay. How is that? How's that brave? How's that cool? You know, so that's what you're doing. So you want to assault me. You know, and a lot of time, you know, reframing it. So again, teaching those compasses, teaching those boundaries, you know, really, really important. Of course, really important with understanding it with adults, because again, this now takes us on to the adult on child violence. And you know, the book has got, we bring a lot of elephants in the room there, you know, the myth of stranger danger. That's the one that I was going, I'm going to really hit that one home. You know, stranger danger is a gimmick. It's a gimmick. It's statistically unproven. It's, you know, statistically it's proven against, rather. And on top of it, when a child is lost, when a child is in trouble, they're going to need to communicate with strangers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you just expand on that a little bit? What do you mean that the strange danger thing is a myth? In terms of, is that because the myth is that all strangers are a danger, or what does that mean?
In nearly every conceivable way, it's a myth in the respect that the likelihood of a stranger assaulting a child is minuscule compared to the likelihood of someone the child knows is going to assault them.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Yep.
Okay. That is borne out statistically. Absolutely. And the truth is that I think it's very comfortable to teach stranger danger. I think to teach stranger danger is really helps. It goes into this kind of tribal mentality where you go, the others, all we've got to worry about is the others.
Yeah.
People outside our group, others. Yeah. The tabloid press love it. Okay, when you get tabloid press, whenever you see, and I'm not sure what the age group is for your particular podcast, but when you see a paedophile, a sex offender, a murderer, okay, is convicted, what are the headlines normally describe that person as? Monster, beast. All these, they either use an animal metaphor.
Yeah.
Or they use a mythological metaphor. And that's really comfortable for us. Phew. I thought it was a human being. I actually thought for a second that we could actually be attacked by our fellow human beings, by people of the same species as us. Thank God for that. I'm glad it's a monster. I'm glad it's actually a monster. I'm glad it's something that I'm not likely to ever see. Okay, or if I'm going to see it, it's going to be in a place like the zoo that I live in, you know, okay, or it's going to be, exactly. I have to be careful with my metaphors, you know. Some of my teachers will say that my place is where metaphors come to die, you know. And people say things like, life's a circus. I go, well, my life actually was, but there you go. You know, my home's like a zoo. We go, well, my home was a zoo, you know. But, you know, so anyway, but yes, so when it comes to, looking at this, you know, the metaphors, you know, of, that you see in the press, the monsters, you know, it's so much comfortable to say, look at that other in our lot, you know, that could attack the children. That's what we've got to worry about, that thing that jumps from the shadows, that nameless monster that jumps in the shadows. It's not strange Uncle Bert at the barbecue who gets a bit handsy, but he's all right because he's just a bit weird. Just watch out for, you know, for that relative, because you know, they're just a bit, it's all right though, you know, or the priest, or the vicar, or the imam, or whatever religious elder in our group, okay, that is just a bit friendly with the young kids that they hangs around with, and come on, you know, we all had to put up with it and all this sort of thing, or in the private school, or the teacher, or the, you know, the kindergarten teacher or something like that, that you just hear these, you know, that it's easier to say it's a monster. It's not the person who comes around and has a cup of tea with you. It's not the person that you've known all your life, you know, which are all the really sort of things that we as a community we're really uncomfortable to address.
So
on that side of it, stranger danger part of it, it's not effective, because all you're doing is it's somebody you don't know. Okay, well, who do I know? You know, how quick is it for a inverted commas stranger to convince a kid that they know? And the other thing is, of course, is that, and again, I'm stealing this from Gavin De Becker, but, you know, and he's protecting the gift, but adults, parents break this rule all the time. You know, the mail person turns up, the postman or the postwoman turns up, or the say thank you to the nice man. Say thank you to the nice woman. Yeah, but he's a stranger. He doesn't come into our house. You know, it's the thing you often were told, you know, strange is a person doesn't come into your house and you don't go into theirs. Well, what about the shopkeeper? You know, that's, be polite. But you just told me not to talk to strangers. But this one's all right. Oh, this one's okay then. Okay, so this one's okay. So no, you know, and this kind of all, you know, so it's like, so that's a mixed met. So you, and of course, as we know, that's often the big problem with kids, isn't it? If you start breaking laws that you set for kids in front of them, they look at you, they model themselves on you, they model themselves, they look for your cues. And if you are not taking what you're teaching them seriously, and you're even telling them to break, oh, this is a grey area and stuff like that, then you get mixed messages and it's getting muddled. Incidentally, there's a Hammer horror, no, it's not a Hammer horror movie, but it's a Hammer films. Hammer Productions made a film in the 1960s called Don't Give Sweets, Don't Take Sweets from Strangers, and Change to America's Don't Take Candy from Strangers, obviously. It wasn't a usual sort of thing you associate with Hammer Studios. I mean, they did a lot more films than just horror movies. But in that film, the actual antagonist, it isn't a stranger, even though it's in the title strangers. He isn't a stranger. He's actually an elder of the community. He's an elder of the village. There's a new family move in, a young girl and her new friend, another young girl from the community, are off playing, and they're assaulted by this elderly man who's in the community. And he turns out he's a very respected elder of the community, so no one believes the kids, they don't believe the adults and all this sort of thing. But of course it turns out he's a respected elder of that community, so he is, you know, which can often happen. And it's interesting to see that the film is actually called Don't Take Sweets from Strangers, Don't Take Candy from Strangers. But actually, when it came down to someone trying to write a realistic story, they realized that the person, in order to make the story realistic, is going to have to be someone they know. Mm-hmm. Not to say strangers don't pray, of course they do. Absolutely, you know, we've got plenty of cases like that. But it's the likelihood, and it's not that we're teaching them not to, you know, not to be aware of predatory strangers, but it's beware of predatory people, full stop. Mm. You know, that's the lesson that needs to be taught. What's acceptable behavior? What are the signs of somebody? What are the deceptive signs that people will use? Listening to your gut, understand, you know, seeing those cues, whether they're aggressive cues or deceptive cues. You know, there's that part of it. The other part of the stranger danger that is damaging is that, as I mentioned earlier on, if a child's lost or in trouble, they might need to go to strangers. In fact, they're more than likely they're going to have to. They're going to need to know who are the people who are safe to go to. You know, I was telling my daughter when she was very young, I remember us, we were at a village fete. And I remember saying to her, you know, she was about 6 years old, and I said to her, you know, if you suddenly lost me, where would you go to? Who would you go to? And this is the thing. And again, one of the activities I set up for in the one of the last chapters of the book, which is called When Parents Are Around. OK, that's exercise that children and parents can do together, is to allow a child to, in a supermarket, for example, you allow a child to go ask for things. And what you do is you supervise that child, obviously, going off to find somebody and ask where something is in the supermarket. And then when you watch the child go to do that, they then report back to you and say, why did you pick that person? So you have a little debrief. Why is that person okay? Would you pick that person? Because, you know, a lot of the time, child, in, you know, mother walking with other children, generally good person to ask. Person in a uniform working at the store, generally a good person to us. Not to say that people don't commit terrible offences, that there are examples of them doing that. But within that capacity, within that context, it's generally speaking, it's safe to us. And they can also, and it can come right down to demeanour as well, like, you know, that person, how they're behaving, all this kind of thing. So they start learning these skills early on. Who do you go to? Who are the more likely person? You know, statistically, and I don't mean this in any form of to be sexist, but women commit far less crimes against children than men, statistically speaking, you know, so, and that kind of thing. And here's the other key. It's the approach. OK, if you're approaching an adult you don't know, it's a lot different to an adult approaching you. Most attacks aren't honey traps for kids. Most attacks are, you know, there's somebody who has proactively gone out there to get you, you know, in order to do that. Mm. So, you know, there's all those, there's all this sort of elements that again, debunk the stranger danger and teach something that is more effective. And that is identifying predatory behaviors, not just having a generalization. That's a very convenient little gimmick, understanding what they're going to do to help them. Because, and in many ways, the part about knowing who to approach is the foundation of what I'm teaching here. When parents aren't around, which means, you know, it's children are left to where, let's say, where they're going to be in charge. They're left in a situation where they've got to decide to be in charge and take charge. And everything about self-protection is about taking charge. It's about saying, these are my boundaries. This is my fence. This is who I'm going to allow to trust. This is who I'm not going to trust. This is what I need to do. You know, so again, it puts them in charge. It puts them in a proactive role. And that's, you know, that's the thing that's taught throughout the book.
Wow.
I love that.
There's so much in there. That's just fascinating. Greg, actually, I've been asking a lot of questions. Greg, do you have questions at this moment? I've got several.
I do. Listening to all that, it's amazing how much it applies to just general self-protection as well as children. So without going too far into it, how different is your children's self-protection teaching compared to your adult self-protection teaching in terms in general, I guess.
Well, when I first gave the book to Jeff Thompson, he said to me, he actually gave some useful criticism, which I used to change the book. And he said, you know, don't patronize kids. OK, and this is not the way I taught anyway. And he said, you know, write the book pretty much how you teach. And I went, OK. And he said, write a simple book. So how I teach kids in many ways is a simpler way of teaching adults.
Yeah.
Should we say? And that's one thing. The other thing is the fact that children have a lot more variables in a way. So even though you teach them in a more simpler way, for example, the size difference is so much of a bigger issue with kids. I mean, obviously we've got different sized adults. I'm not saying that we don't, but a child's world is a lot more varied in that respect. So ranges, so physical ranges become really, really important.
Okay, so we had a little moment of technical difficulties there. So we're back again. So Greg's just going to re-ask that question because to just in case the interference got too much. So yeah. Greg, off you go.
So what I was asking was the difference in your approach to teaching children self-protection, adult self-protection, just because a lot of the stuff you've been talking about with the children self-protection seems like it can cross over very easily to the adult side of things.
Well, that's definitely true. And in many respects, a lot of the stuff that I teach to children is simplified variations for adults. But also children have to take on a lot of differences with adults. I think in an adult world, certain boundaries and social norms are better established than they are with children. Again, because we're talking about children, there's all these different age groups. And, you know, a 7-year-old outlook on life is very different to a 10-year-old's outlook on life. It's very different to a 13-year-old's outlook on life. So with all those things into consideration, that I have to adapt my training accordingly to that. A lot of the stuff with children is also about recruiting help, understanding how to engage bystanders. I think children, that is a bigger skill with children than it is with adults in a lot of situations, certainly on the soft skills side of matters. Again, a lot of the stuff that I'm teaching children, you can make assumptions with adults, such as, you know, why you shouldn't fight somebody because they've annoyed you and things like that. I mean, I know adults do it, but with kids, sometimes it can be, you know, this is their daily interaction. So a lot of the time, understanding and establishing what their moral compass is, establishing what their what's acceptable and not acceptable behaviour, that needs to be more emphasized. From a physical side, of course, children have a wider variety of different size issues. You know, there can be lots of different, for example, the back of the book, the two models on the back of the book come from the same year group. And yet you wouldn't think that by their size differences. They've, you know, one's a whole head taller than the other. It looks like the other one's at least 2 years older, but they're not tall. They're from the same age group. They're from the same year group. So the size part of it is really, really important. That also feeds into children's ability to be agile. I mean, their size offers them a lot of advantages with being agile, ducking in, moving away, some on the physical side of it. The tactical escape, in many ways, is more sophisticated than it would be for adults. You know, whereas adults, there are less places compared to a child for an adult to get away, to move around, and a child can use that to their advantage from an agile, from agility perspective. So physically, and definitely from a soft skills perspective, there are those main differences, normally on emphasis, I would say.
Interesting.
So I think we're both just kind of absorbing so much stuff there. It's just so
I think I think I've answered a lot of your earlier questions in my ramble.
it's good.
I think you have. I'd like to hear more about the book itself. So this is a book for children.
Yeah.
But it also says that it's a great idea if children read the book with an adult, or if an adult knows that they're reading the book. So the book goes through several different sections. So do you want to give us a little bit more of a rundown about what children can expect to find in the book?
Okay. Well, the first thing I would like to address with that is this, the idea that it should be read with an adult. So yes, obviously, I'm seeing a situation where a child on their own might be in their library, or might be looking online, and they see this book and they go, oh, this could answer my problems, or this could be something that I'll be interested in because I'm anxious about, violent situations, and it's a, and it'll be a resource that will, you know, that they'll want to go to. However, what I learned early on when I taught, and I say this in the first chapter, which is a message to the parents, and it's written, the first chapter is written for the parents for that reason. Children can read it, of course, but it's written for the parents. And that was when I first started teaching children self-protection. I started to realize that none of this was really going to land, a little of this is going to land without the parents backing, you know, and furthermore, some of the stuff might be deemed as controversial. You know, there could be a number of things, you know, teaching a child to physically act first in a violent situation, for example, if you frame that the wrong way, it just sounds like you're teaching kids to assault other kids. So, I've taught preemptive striking to children in front of the principals of schools, and they've had no problem with it at all because the way it's framed. When you frame it and it's all built up and they understand it, and also the fact that I'm not giving lip service to the non-physical stuff, the fact that the physical stuff has the greatest emphasis in this book, and lays the foundation for whatever physical stuff goes on, is important. But again, this, you know, you need to have the parents on board, and I've had both the advantages and disadvantages of which has proven that, you know, so when I've, you know, not had a parent involved with their child's training straight away, you know, you'll have issues like the child's been bullied at school and the child hasn't been able to effectively employ anything, and the parents gone, well, you know, so much you're teaching. I actually had that, a very, very a tiny isolated case. And of course, the parent wasn't there emphasizing the information I was teaching. Whereas I've had loads of feedback from supportive parents, you know, the majority of them, where they've, where it's really improved their child's life at school and in general, because they've been right behind their kids. They've been helping to teach the lessons to the kids when they've gone away, and they've sat in on my lessons, you know, really engaged this parent-teacher relationship, which became really important from when I ran my classes. And so I realized how important that was. And also, you know, self-protection is teaching people behaviors, so these can't be things that you just leave in the lesson. You know, these are things that will be part of your everyday behavior. They're lifestyle choices. So the only way these lifestyle choices can be taken on properly for with children is if the parents are actively engaged. That's why the last chapter that I described earlier, when parents are around, is all the exercises children and adults can do together. So you've got the adults at the beginning saying, a chapter for the adults at the beginning where they say, where I say to them, you need to understand the information that's being taught here. You need to be cool with the information that's being taught here, and understand that the children are going to need your support in order for them, for any of this to be effective and for anything, for this to be an efficient way of learning. So, and then in between that, we have all the other chapters which addresses the children directly. And I'm covering a broad range of ages, okay, which I appreciate. Is a struggle, but it's worked, you know. Again, and I've run classes with 8 and 9 year olds in the same class as 12 and 13 year old, and they've all got something out of it, and it's been beneficial. But I'm aiming at that, and I didn't shy away from it. And those chapters address pretty fundamental things. Everything from, we handled fighting very early on because we thought, well, let's get that out of the way. Let's get out of the way. Let's because people think of self-defense, they think of martial arts, they think of
absolutely.
Yeah, and this is the thing. And all the issues connected to that come forward. So on one side of it, you've got people not believing it's going to work because they see a fight between a child and a much larger child, and they think that no matter what the other child's learned, you know, it's hocus pocus, it's going to be rubbish, it's not going to work, or a child versus an adult's not going to work. And you go, yeah, because this is not what we're looking at. We're not talking about and we're not talking about symmetrical fighting. We're not talking about consensual violence. What we're talking about is preventing, avoiding, de-escalating violent situations. And then if something does happen, it's an asymmetrical physical situation where one person is fighting in order to prevent being hurt and to escape. You know, the narrative is so important to get this across. So that's the fighting chapter addresses that to say, you know, pretty much what we discussed earlier on about the mentality about fighting and how it's not about fighting. And as soon as you consent to a fight, then straight away your problems with arguing that you're defending yourself become apparent. But also you've already now, the stuff that I'm teaching about self-protection doesn't come into it because you're no longer fighting to stop someone from hurting you. So you're no longer defending it.
So I thought it, just as we were talking about that, I know that you've been very clear in your writing, I've seen that, about the difference between self-defense and self-protection, but I think it might be worth just taking a quick second to just really define that for us.
Okay, right. So it's not me, it's Peter Considine. I pretty much learned from him, and then Mo Teague. So self-protection is an all-encompassing term for methods for reducing and managing interpersonal violence. Okay, so it's as simple as that. And it comprises of two areas. One area is soft skills and the other area is hard skills. So it might be titled as self-defense and personal security. So personal security comes under soft skills, but I also extend that to the aftermath, which again is one of the updates in this book. Again, we said we're going to address some of the updates in the new version, but that's one of the updates. Actually, funny enough, on the advice of my editor, I teach it to kids, but I hadn't actually put it into the book. It's a very, very important part. You know, a lot of people, when they teach self-protection, they teach pre-fight, in-fight, and then they really don't give a lot of time to post-fight. And yet post-fight is often where we get them, isn't it? That's often where the student turns up. It's that they're dealing with their post fight. They're dealing with their aftermath. Psychological impact. Of the incident. So the aftermath is really, really important. So when we talk about personal security and we talk about soft skills, we're talking about the pre and post fight elements, and also information that underlines the in fight as well. I'd say that all of that, you know, is all part. You know, it's, that's why that's so big. So self protection is the all-encompassing term. I keep saying, you know, these are semantics, but self-defense is important for me to use to illustrate the hard skills. That's the physical stuff. So specifically, it's the physical stuff. Why? Because it's a legal term. This is something else that, you know, we try to address with people when we talk about self-defense. When someone says, I use my karate on him. I use my kung fu on him. I use my kickboxing on him. Do people ever say that anymore? But I use it, you know, they are specifically listing names of styles or systems or disciplines. Whereas, you know, a police officer, a judge, a jury, you're going to go, yeah, right, whatever. You know, that's not in our law books. You know, that's not a term. I use self-defense. Oh, no. Now we'll decide whether you did do self-defense or not, because we are qualified to decide whether that's self-defense. Yeah. Because why? Because it's a legal term. Okay, you know, that's really, really important. That's the way I give it in semantics. I mean, it's not massively important. Different people, you know, describe it in different ways. But for me, it's just an easy way to outline it, to say this is self-protection. Within self-protection, the soft skills and hard skills. Soft skills are personal security. The hard skills are self-defense. And self-defense is something that you can find in a law book. And that's one of the updates that's in the new version as well, is discussing the legal side with children. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry, carry on.
No, I was just going to say that's so important.
Yeah, absolutely.
The self-protection is everything that's in your book, isn't it? That self-defense and the physical stuff is such a small part of this, but self-protection is how one conducts oneself through life.
Yes, absolutely. And when you say self-defense, that's what we're describing. It's what could be legally defined as being self-defense. You know, that's our discussion point. We're not, you know, that way it takes it out of the discussion. It's not combative. It's not martial arts. It's not, you know, these are all elements that can help and lend themselves to, and we can draw from. But specifically, it's like, is this something that you can legally defend yourself with? You know, is this something that's legally justifiable? Is this something that you could say in front of 12 of your own peers? You've used for justification, you know, as your, you know, and this is just it. I mean, so in the UK, in England and Wales anyway, not necessarily in Scotland, it's a little different, but in England and Wales, a child is criminally responsible from the age of 10. Okay, in Scotland it's 12, and it differs in certain countries. But I'm English. I'm writing in England. And so with that in mind, you know, when it comes to talking about the physical side of things, well, if a child is appreciate they're not going to be, you know, if they were punished by the justice system, it's going to be different to whether an adult would be punished up until the age of 17, 18. But they're still considered to be legally responsible, you know, still considered to be criminally, you know, responsible for, you know, criminal offence. So with that in mind, right or wrong, we need to equip children to have a degree of responsibility. You know, if this is where the law is looking at it, you know, personally, I think it's too young. But that's not. But what I think doesn't matter. It's what we're given with. We know what we're handed. So we're saying, right, 10-year-old enters your class and wants to learn self-protection, and you can teach them some self-defense skills. You've got to know that. That person is criminally responsible. Therefore, they could be dealt. You know, they could be attacked by somebody who could potentially kill them. Because, you know, a lot of people go, well, okay, do we teach children this? Do we teach children that? Well, it's more like saying, well, what's the threat, and what are the skills that we're going to use to handle that particular threat? Mm. And a child has got just as much right as an adult to be able to physically defend themselves against something. And newsflash: children do and will kill other children. And this is what's happened, you know, and, you know, so we can say that all day long about, you know, oh, no, this could be too dangerous, child, they're not responsible enough. And yeah, we know that because other kids do it to them. But how do they defend against that? How do they defend against that kind of situation? How do they handle that situation? So, and again, making them aware. I mean, straight away, I mean, it's straight in there. The legal side of it is mentioned directly. Not patronizing to the child reader, so they understand. And I say this, you know, when I teach children self-protection, you know, I talk about, you know, the legal side of it, because it's important that we understand what self-defense is and what we mean by self-defense, rather than just using it banding around term that could mean means whatever people think it means.
Yeah,
well, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean what you think it means. It means what a judge and a jury will decide what it means if this goes to court, you know. So and that's where you've got to be mindful of that when you are saying you're teaching self-defense. And anyone who doesn't if anyone says they're teaching self-defense and doesn't address the legal side of it, or doesn't understand the basic on the legal side of it, you know, is doing their students a disservice. They're not actually teaching them, you know, they're not being responsible for what they've titled their actual teaching. So yes, that, and again, that's one of the updates. As I said earlier on, you wanted to address some of the updates of the book.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Talk us through some of the updates and how those have come about.
Yeah, no, I'll say, well, the aftermath was suggested by my editor. So I'd always taught the aftermath side of it. But he said, because straight away he noticed I'd referencing, the emotional side of what happened afterwards and who to talk to. And he said, and I think it was even in reference to my glossary or something. And he was saying, you need to elaborate on this, you know, maybe do a chapter. And it's not a long chapter. And it just deals with, first aid, not the skills of first aid, but to say that, you know, as part of your learning, you should really do a first aid course for children. You should understand some basic first aid. You should understand about reporting, you know, giving yourself that time to come down after a situation as well. You know, even if you could, you might need to speak to a teacher. You might need to speak to a member of the law, depending on how serious this situation is, you know, and give yourself a good 48 hours so that, you know, you don't necessarily speak to somebody. So you could be, you know, you're in a stressful state, you know, you could say the wrong thing, you could say things that are not true, even though you don't intend to say them not true, but they could sound worse than what they actually are. You need to be able to get back and not let anyone harass you into giving a statement. So these things are important. Who to speak to, in an assault situation, speaking to and to make sure that you do speak to them. And that it's okay to feel these bad feelings that you'll feel afterwards. You'll feel a variety of feelings, and that the bravest people in the world have these feelings. All the natural come down from the situation, and then you might send. There could be you could have relapses months afterwards, you know, which you hadn't experienced before, and it can happen. And this is natural, and it's important to, you know, to talk to people about this and to be able to manage it, you know, and also the black dog, of course, which, you know, and also what we might put under the title of could have's, you know, as we always look at situations, or I should have done that or whatever. You know, the past is the past, understanding that, that's moved on. You've survived this situation, and whatever happens, you've survived this situation. So you've done something right and to make peace with that. So the aftermath part was important. The legal side of it, as we just discussed, was important. The obvious one was the virtual world, social media, that part of it. That was completely absent from the first edition. Writing, you know, just shows you just how huge that is now. So I've done the best I can to future-proof it. I haven't addressed any particular social media platforms. None of them are mentioned by name, but I think it's a fair guess that social media is going to be around for a long time going forward. And you know, the time we're writing in, it's more relevant than ever before. Everything from cyber stalking to cyber bullying. All these different areas as well. So that they're mentioned in the different chapters. I haven't done a separate chapter for it because, as far as I'm concerned, you know, cyberbullying is seen as a separate thing, but it is part of bullying. And again, it's all part of my principal approach, if you know what I mean, a principal-led approach, rather than you don't need to compartmentalize some of these certain things. You know, stalking is stalking, you know, whether it's done online or whether it's done face to face. You know, it's when you understand that, and you just understand about that, then people, you're training your reader, you're training your student to have a more adaptive mind. You know, there are five tenets I use throughout the book that come back, that there are a hangover from my classes, and they are RACDO, RACDO, it's the acronym: respect, awareness, courage, discipline, and open mind. And the open mind one, of course, addresses adaptability. You know, so it's not having a mind that's so open that your brain falls out. It's having a mind that, you know, if anything, as you know, I don't teach blind belief in anything. You know, skepticism is one of the big and critical thing is the big part of what I teach. So you know, the open mind I teach in any ways, it could be being more critical, but it's being open to different situations, different scenarios, and different training methods that can improve your training, that can update your training. So you're always modernizing, you're always going forward. So and part of that, again, is addressing social media, is addressing the virtual world. So that's another one of the big updates that's in there. Now, the other thing was going further with the Stranger Danger myth. And that's addressing even things like abduction. So abductions handled, and that used to be a whole second part of the seminars I used to teach. But as time's gone on, again, this comes back to the likelihood of abductions by strangers. Although they happen and they continue to happen, and they're important to address, the likelihood is that an abduction will happen with somebody the child knows. Yeah. And one of the most uncomfortable truths is that it could be a parent. Okay, so now we're stuck with a situation where I'm teaching a book when parents aren't around, which I want parents on board to be reading with me. And now I'm putting the possibility that what a child could be protecting themselves against might even be a parent. But let's look at the situation. You know, we're in a world where, you know, you could have parents who are separated. You know, there's a custody case going on. You know, so just a simple word of just saying to a child, you know, if your parents don't live together, it's important to know which one's going to be collecting you today, you know, from school. Just something as simple as that. We don't need to go into all the, you know, there's far better qualified people who can handle that side of it all. And as I said, you know, I don't want parents to feel like, you know, I'm sure all responsible parents who'd read that would go, yeah, okay, that's fair enough. You know, it's the statistics bear it out. So, but it's important, and I struggled with whether I was going to put it in or not for a while, just thinking, you know, am I going to alienate him from that thing? Well, no, I shouldn't, because I'm sure any responsible parent would say, well, yeah, you know, some kids, you know, if the statistics say that the likelihood you're going to be abducted and that abduction would happen from a parent, then those are the circumstances where that happens. So yeah, so that's another one of the updates that's in the book.
Wow, it's brutal, isn't it? It must have been tough for you to write some of that.
Yeah, well, kids were honest with me, so I want to be honest with them when it came to writing. I thought it was my duty to be honest with them. So, you know, some of the best teachers that taught me self-protection skills were known for being controversial with what they had to say. People like Mo Teague, yeah. Jeff Thompson, they were absolutely brutal about what they said about things. They exposed and upset a lot of people. But ultimately, it's because they were telling the truth. They were telling what they honestly saw as being the truth, what the evidence was showing it. So I felt that it was my duty that if I was going to carry this over to teaching young people and children this thing, that I needed to, you know, have that same degree of honesty. And then I thought, well, and let's, you know, if we're going to deal with self-protection, let's deal with it in an honest way. And again, you know, a lot of time it debunked a lot of myths that I believed in. I mean, I'm learning stuff all the time. You know, stuff we're learning about the bystander effect. You know, there's a lot of stuff out there that information's updated. I mean, you know, that's the nature of it's the nature of life, isn't it?
Yeah,
it is. It sounds amazing. It also sounds like not just amazing for kids and their carers, guardians, parents, but also information in there for any adult as well.
Mm. Thank you.
Yeah, it does. Sounds amazing. I'm going to get it. Read it more. I'm going to be amazing. Okay, is there anything that we've missed in there, Jamie, that you really wanted to make a point about anything? Because I want to make sure you've got all of it there.
Not really. As I said, it's. I suppose the one thing is to say that my purpose for writing this was not to create a system or style or something. There isn't a when parents aren't around system as such. There's an approach. And it can be used as a bolt-on for martial arts classes. So if you run a martial arts school, it's the sort of thing you could teach alongside it. You know, so it's going forward, I want the when parents aren't around to be not only courses and seminars that are based on the book, but we're also looking at doing extended courses specifically for different age groups that will have that hopefully we're going to have badges and also be able to certify teachers to run those courses, and it'll all be connected to the When Parents Are Around thing. But it's the sort of thing that, as I said, you know, even on the basis of just getting the book, you know, if you've got the book for your school, for your students, this isn't something where it's saying, well, this is another style. You know, what I would hope is that a lot of this stuff is common sense. A lot of this stuff is going to align with sensible teaching. It's not contradictory to any sort of sensible teaching, so to speak, but works as a good complement to responsible martial arts teaching for children.
Awesome. Yeah, I like what you said there about schools having a copy. Because I often wonder, like, and you touched on it briefly, how well equipped sometimes the teachers, heads of schools, how well equipped they are to deal with students coming to them about being bullied.
Agreed.
Things like that.
And, agreed. Absolutely. This exact. I'm saying, when it comes to schools, there's a few issues that have been raised where. Well, it's certainly because the clients that have come to me, because obviously a lot of what I do is a lot of PTs now. So, and back in the day, people like Peter Considine would send a concerned member of the BCA would have children's, and say, no, I want to do children's self-protection. Is there any way that teaches self-protection? And Peter would send them to me. And when we would do an intensive self-protection or anti-bullying course for a child, you know, who's being targeted by bullies. So this stuff was going to go straight out into the field, so to speak. You know, this isn't just like, little Jenny's going to school, I'm a bit worried about bullies, so let's do some prevention. This is more like, no, my child's being targeted. The teachers are doing nothing about it, okay? Or they've been to several schools, they're clearly a target. I want to equip them so that they're going to get bullied, so I want to equip them the best way to deal with that situation. So we would do the courses and resolve the problem. So, yes, the situation with schools are an awareness... creating a sense of awareness in children about what is self-defense is important information.
Yeah.
Because it's not retaliation. You know, this is often the feedback that you get. And I know loads of instances where kids have been bullied or they've taken on physical punishment from other children because they're terrified of fighting back because they're going to get in trouble themselves.
You
know, and it's massive disempowerment that goes on. And, you know, and it's often, I mean, we get this, it goes all the way up to adults, doesn't it? You know, the average law-abiding citizen walks into the wrong bar in the wrong area, gets targeted by the local bully, you know, as an adult, you know, and they're worried that, oh my God, I'm going to get a criminal record if I get caught in a fight here. And they don't realise, what are my rights? And, you know, a lot of people are ignorant to what their rights are with self-defence. So that then could carry on very easily to being a school teacher, that same person who would be worried about getting involved in a fight. I mean, I had one teacher say at a school, what would you do if you were physically attacked? Well, I'd let them keep hitting me until they got bored. I actually heard that from a teacher telling students. You know, it was a very extreme turn the other cheek attitude. Not only recently I heard that, and I was going, what you know, you're putting a hell of a lot of faith in that person not seriously hurting you, okay? You've got no reason to trust whatsoever. You know, so you're trusting someone who's violent to know when to stop being violent to you because they're going to get bored. Okay, so there was that, and then you have this thing about. We don't allow retaliation. We don't allow retaliation. You're going, self-defense is not retaliation. In fact, it's defined as it mustn't be revenge. You know, when someone legally looks at it, if you ask the likes of, you know, better people on the legal side of it, people like Lee Sims, who wrote his excellent book on law and self-protection now, and is my constant go-to resource, and also people like Mark Dawes, you know, they often look at it and go, you know, it's not getting back at somebody. Self-defense has got nothing to do with retaliation or revenge. So when you teach a child self-defense, you're teaching them how to best exercise their right to preserving their physical safety from physical violence. This is their legal right, and this is what it means. And it absolutely does not mean revenge or retaliation. So that shouldn't even be brought into the discussion. It's not a consensual fight, and it's not getting back at somebody. Yeah, and so so I agree. A lot of schools would be better equipped with that understanding and knowing that everybody understands what that is.
Yeah.
I think you're right. I think you're right. And I'm just suddenly remembering that I know somebody whose daughter is going through some stuff right now. and I'm going to be sending her a copy really quickly because because it's a difficult one.
I appreciate that from that point, but yeah, it is, and I often find that it's something that needs to be addressed straight on. This is why when people actually are dealing with bullying situations, they don't need abstract answers. You need something to say, well, yeah, I'm worried about physical violence. My child could be facing physical violence. There's limited what I can do other than teach them at home and not allow them out of the house. Okay, that's the only thing I can I could ever possibly do to handle this situation, which is gonna cause serious problems for their future and their social interaction. So how do I deal with this? What you don't need is an abstract lesson. You need direct skills that are going to help them. And that's what I hope my book's going to provide, and by extension my courses and seminars.
Let's just bring this all home. This has been so amazing. Where is the book available? How can people buy it?
Okay, the book's available either through Amazon. You can just order a copy directly from Amazon. Okay, it's now live, both as an ebook and as a paperback at the moment. I'm under plans to develop an audiobook in the future as well. They want a signed copy, they can email me directly at jamieclub@clubchimera.com. Spelling for Club Chimera, clubbchimera. So there are two ways that you can do it. So either come directly through me and I'll send you a signed copy, or you can order it directly through Amazon.
Cool.
Awesome.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much indeed, Jamie.
Thank you very much. And thank you for appreciating what I'm trying to do as well. It's great. It's great having sympathetic listeners.
You've got very interested listeners here, very supportive listeners.
Absolutely.
I've learned so much about, I had no idea about any of this when I started martial arts. Literally none. So what I've learned from
that's two of us.
What I've learned from listening to people like you and Mary and Joe has absolutely revolutionized the way I think about this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
I did actually have one last very quick question. How can teachers, such as martial arts teachers, how can they learn from you? You have seminars going on. They can just get in touch with you, drop you a line, come to a seminar.
Yeah, absolutely. There are different teachers who are hosting me to teach courses and seminars. If you want me for a booking in that respect, I can do that. I travel pretty much anywhere. I teach internationally, but I can also teach virtually as well. If you want to do the webinar format, if anyone's still interested in doing that, that's a budget saving method. But I'm happy to travel anywhere to teach. I do private lessons as well. It's a big part of what I do. There's constant updates on my website. I every lesson I teach, I blog. I don't mention necessarily people's names, but I blog every single lesson I teach, so that it's good for both my clients, but also for other people looking for the information. And so we've got a constant record of that. So absolutely, please just get in contact. Same way as you'd get in contact for a signed copy, that's the jamie@clubchimera.com, or the website, which is clubchimera.com.
Awesome. And you're, am I right in saying you're going to be at the Martial Arts Festival this year?
I am. It's the first time I've ever, taught at an event like that in over a decade. It's
awesome.
I've turned down offers since then and not really had much interest in this. But this one looks like it's generally going to be something very different, I think. I like seeing what Matt wants to do with it. I'm going with his... with what he's told me what it's going to be all about, and it sounds very exciting, and I look forward to being there for a couple of days. That'll be the weekend.
We will hopefully catch you there, so maybe if we can do something there,
can we have another podcast with you?
Another follow-up to this, a brief
absolutely
an in-person chat or something.
As I know that Greg has an urgent need to talk to you about what is it called, Dead Souls.
Oh, right.
Oh, yeah. That's
covering my murky history that I glossed over.
Yeah.
It's in there. That, I think, to be honest. I think
Greg really needs to talk to you about that.
It just seemed cool. I was like, this seems awesome.
Cool.
All right. That's the plan then. Can we talk again and talk about all the other stuff?
Okay, yeah, absolutely. Well, hopefully there'll be another book out before long. The next book after this is going to be something totally different. It's going to be the Bullshit Zoo book. So
nice.
So that's something I've been working on since, well, at least 2015, I think, actually, but it's going to be a multi-volume thing. So that'll keep me probably. I think anyone will talk to me after that.
We will.
We love it. Promise. I love the name. I love all of that.
Yeah. It's going to be Bullshit Zoo in the Fight to Make Martial Arts Work.
I love it. I'm there.
Okay.
Thanks, Jamie. That's been so
great.
Thank
you so much.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you, guys.
Take care and good luck with our book.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Bye.